come back from working out, right? And my dad texts me around 2 o'clock. And I get this text that says, I went to the hardware store today and I smelled shit like somebody farted. I'm reading this verbatim, by the way. I turned down the aisle and I see a man scurry away. Then I saw why. He had dropped a load of shit out of his leg onto the floor. And then he put, I swear to God. And I'm like, all right, he's got to be messing with me. So he comes home and he tells me a story. He goes, I was in the hardware store and it just smelled really bad. And I turn around and there's just a pile of shit. And he says he has to go up to the owner of the store. And he goes, ma'am, there's a, and he couldn't get it out. He was crying. He was laughing so hard. He was gagging, laughing and crying at the same time. He goes, ma'am, there's a, what, sir? There's a, and then he told her, and she goes, what the fuck? So my dad's in there. He just went in for tools from the hardware store, and there it is, a giant soft serve right on the floor. They were checking the cameras to find out who the guy was.
So a man's just did it. He just did it to him.
He just in the middle of the night. He just dropped a cake out of his shorts. He just flicked it out of his leg.
Did the manager think? Did the manager accuse your dad?
That's what I would think, right? Apparently, somebody might have slipped in it because it looked like there was a shoe print. So I can only imagine.
Oh no! Going, oh.
And he said there was not. I said there's no animals allowed in there. And he said he saw a guy run away. So you got somebody, the mad pooper, coming through.
Did they catch him? Did they catch the bandit?
Unfortunately, he's still on the loose.
He's still at large?
He's still at large, but we checked the corn, and we think we've got a DNA sample.
Welcome to the Pretentious Movie Sheet Podcast. My name is Brian.
I am the mad pooper, Christian.
Oh, boy, we got some shit today, friends and family.
Let's hopefully you don't step in it.
Yeah, no, watch your step as we trudge forward into the movie bracket for the best horror movie of all time. Today on the docket, we have Jaws from 1975, Steven Spielberg versus Peeping Tom. From 1960, the same year as Psycho from Michael Powell. That's how you pronounce it, right? Powell?
Yeah, I believe so. And you want to know something? It's funny that it came out the same year as Psycho. It came out right before Psycho. There's a bunch of parallels, which you'll probably see as soon as we get into the podcast and we start talking about the plot. But funny enough that this movie was so critically panned that Alfred Hitchcock completely canceled and shut down all of his press conferences for Psycho because of the fear of how they would take his film.
Normally, that's a really bad sign for when a film is coming out. And you have to wonder, like, oh, are they getting rid of... are they getting rid of press screenings because they think the movie is going to be just that bad? But no, it turned out it was Psycho, one of the number one seed. That's how good it was.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing to see how inspirational Peeping Tom was, especially for movies that would come out later that decade or even early in the next decade.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, I mean, you know, influential. I mean, is there a film more influential than Jaws? Because like that was the first blockbuster.
It really was. And I think people don't realize this. And when I was doing a lot of research for it, the only thing I could liken it to is Endgame, of the anticipation and the event that it was. People lined up around the block just for one movie. People went multiple times just to talk about it. It truly was the event of the summer. And, you know, I talked to my parents. I talked to people that were around during the time. They still remember being afraid to go in the water because of this movie.
When those people wrapped around the block, would you say that they busted it?
They block busted it.
But before we get into both those films, what have you been watching recently?
So I haven't been watching too many movies, but lately I've been watching, going back and watching some good old MTV Unplugs. If you haven't, highly recommend it. They have all of Nirvana and Alice in Chains up on YouTube. Both fantastic. Both lead singers taken way too soon. It's really incredible to see both of them, because for Nirvana and for Alice in Chains, this was like one of their last recorded concerts with their original lineups.
Really?
Yeah. No, funny enough, months later, Kurt Cobain would kill himself after that legendary performance. And Layne Staley kind of went into seclusion for years before finally passing away to a heroin and cocaine overdose.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, but I mean, both amazing, amazing performances. If anybody hasn't seen them, even if you've heard them before, it really doesn't do it justice until you finally see them in action. And if you've just heard the recordings on a CD or on Apple Music or on Spotify, you get all the mistakes and all the little jokes and banter between everybody. And one of the best things, and I highly, highly recommend anybody to go back and watch it. I forget exactly what song they do this on, but they start asking for requests from the crowd, Nirvana, Kurt Cobain. And everybody starts shouting out requests, and he starts rejecting all of them. And he starts, it seems like he gets frustrated by the question that he posts. Somebody says In Bloom. He goes, how the fuck are we supposed to play In Bloom acoustic? Somebody says Rate Me. He goes, sure. But somebody said Freebird, the Leonard Skinner song. And the Meat Puppets who are playing with them start playing Sweet Home Alabama. And Kurt Cobain starts singing, but this is how he starts singing. I could swear to you, this is exactly how it sounds. So you just hear that, dun, 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 and he goes,
I didn't realize he took inspiration from Yoko Ono.
Yeah, exactly.
On the topic of things we've watched this week, I haven't really been watching a lot of things, not even really YouTube-wise. I've been binging, for the most part, Watergate Dragon Deep, which is a D&D module.
I was going to say, watching a lot of wrestling over there with Dragon Gate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gotta get them graps, my guy. No, but
Richard Nixon's putting everybody in crossface cripplers.
Yeah. Oh wait, did I say Watergate? I meant Waterdeep. God, we're all over the place.
All over the place. Richard Nixon, Brian Danielson, Dragon Gate.
But I've been working on getting that campaign together for a couple of friends. So I'm trying to binge through. I've been doing that. I'm playing Hearthstone, but. Yeah, no, I mean, that's me this week. But sweet, you ready? You ready for these two titans to compete?
Oh, I'm ready for these two titans. I was born ready for these two titans.
Sounds good.
This is like Godzilla and Mecha Godzilla going one-on-one with each other.
Dude, Godzilla was last week. The film begins, well, not with Brody, but he comes on soon after. He comes
start
on
off with skinny dipping, Brian.
Yeah, with Chrissy Watkins. And then Brody comes in after he finds half of her. You know, it starts with the skinny dipping scene, which is, I don't think it's quite as iconic as the shower scene in Psycho, but I mean, it's up there.
It's definitely up there. And Since we're talking about Peeping Tom today, we got to talk about the Peeping Toms that worked on this movie, because my God, there are so many upskirt shots underwater throughout this whole thing. But no, that it's like so many iconic scenes in this film. And when you see the opening of, well, not even just the opening, just any death, it just brings you back to that iconic poster of just seeing somebody kind of relax, chilling, swimming, enjoying life while this giant menacing creature is underneath.
So famously, they had so much trouble with the mechanics of the shark that they actually, I guess they cut a lot of the earlier scenes with the shark, or I don't know if it was always intentional to hide most of the movie, but they notoriously had that.
They had to cut a lot. The shark was lovingly named Bruce, or by many of the people that worked on it, but they also named it the Great White Turd. And there was a reason why. So, like Brian said, you don't see the shark until an hour and 2 minutes in the movie. Do we actually get a good shot of the shark? And it's because the first day they put the shark in the water, it sank.
Which is great. That's a great start to your production. It's just like, you know, the main focus, it's gone.
This movie has considerably the worst production you could imagine. It was plagued with problems between. So if you don't know, the movie was only supposed to run from May 1st to June 28th. So that's about 2 months of filming. It ended up filming for 7. And 4 of those months were just spent on sea, way over budget. I honestly don't know how Spielberg didn't get fired, because this was before Spielberg was known as this legendary director. It was before Spielberg like really meant anything.
It was his first big catch, you could say.
Yeah, and see what you did there.
Waka waka.
It's funny because the producers even said that if they read the book that it's based on by Peter Benchley, that they said they never would have funded this. So thank you guys for half-assing your job and not doing any sort of research for a movie you put millions of dollars into.
Hey, I mean, it turned out, honestly, I know we've only looked at 4 movies so far. This is the best one so far.
Oh, definitely. And it shows, because it got nominated that year, or it won that year, excuse me, for score, sound editing, sound mixing. It was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah. Probably should have won.
What won
that year, do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I kind of want to see that now. I'll pull that up right now.
While you're pulling that up, I'll just kind of keep chugging through the plot. Brody, of course, realizes that there's a shark on the loose. However, the mayor does not want to shut down the beaches because 4th of July is coming up. That is the big time for them to make money on the beach. There is eventually another attack, which Brody witnesses himself in a scene that's edited really, really well. Eventually, the mother of that attack, or the mother of the son that was killed in that attack, blames Brody, even though he was the one that was trying to jump down the beach. There's a scene where they are having the meeting, talking about what they're going to do regarding this town hall meeting. That's when Quint has his legendary discussion or story of what a shark is like. Any thoughts on Quint in this scene?
Quint is easily it's a tie between him and Cooper that are both of my favorite characters. And by the way, their relationship in this film is fantastic. I really love the two. Quint is the man who played him, Robert Shaw, did a little bit of writing for himself in this film, which is why I think the character works so well, and why I think it's so so true to him, because I have one little side story here. So if you don't know that Robert Shaw had a notable drinking problem while filming with Jaws.
Really?
And Yeah, they assigned him a PA to make sure he wouldn't drink. So whenever no producers, directors, or anybody were in an earshot of him, he'd take the PA and get drunk. So they'd have to keep giving him new PAs. But I think that's why he works so well. And if you know the scene where he talks about the Indianapolis, it's he got so he used real brandy when he was filming that scene, and he is so blackout drunk that they had to film that scene again. But Spielberg liked it so much that he intercut it with the drunk takes. So it's fun to watch it back because you can tell which ones he's drunk. It's kind of like that Orson Welles commercial.
the French.
You can see his eyes are like so watery in other takes, and other takes he's completely normal. Quinn is a sea scoundrel. He really is. He's a shanty. He's an interesting guy. I like the nauticalness to Quinn. I really like the jadedness to him, but his character is very layered, and I Quinn is probably the most enjoyable character out of the three. And that's saying something, because I really did like everybody in this film.
He is nearly as nautical as I would say what's his name in Lighthouse. I can't believe.
Oh, Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe in Lighthouse.
You fonder me lobster, boy.
Yeah, you fonder my lobster, aren't you? He would fit in right there with him and Robert Pattinson. At least I could remember Batman there. But yeah, no, it's so they catch a tiger shark locally. I'm skipping over Matt Hooper. Matt Hooper shows up. He's like, yeah, I don't know about this tiger shark. I don't think that's going to be what you took these bites.
Well, let's also acknowledge the fact that Matt Hooper shows up in full Orange Cassidy gear. Denim head to toe.
He does. He might as well be putting up a half-ass like thumbs up.
I was waiting for him to put his hands in his pockets and start swimming towards the shark.
He does do an Orange Cassidy move later. But does. we shall cross that bridge later. But Richard Dreyfuss is really great here, and he had some issues with Quint behind the scenes, right?
Yeah, I believe so. I did come across that.
They did not like each other.
Which is funny, because I really do think they had the best on-screen chemistry out of anybody in the film.
Of course, absolutely.
And I really do love every scene that both Dreyfuss and Shaw are in together. It's strange, because I've always wondered that. I don't know if I could have such great loving chemistry with people I can't get along with. I guess that's just the mark of a true actor. I know Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor didn't like each other, but my God, do they work well together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, later on we'll be examining whatever happened to Baby Jane, and apparently the two lead actresses in that, apparently they really did not like each other. Though, I mean, at least in that movie,
I think added to the film.
That's true. That's true, because
they're not trying to be friends.
Oh, not in the least.
I always wonder. Do you think that, like, many of these famous dynamic duos or groups, do you think they absolutely despise each other outside of their project? Like, I imagine Cheech and Chong are probably throwing hands at each other.
I don't know about them.
Clean up the act.
I know that. I think, if I recall correctly, and I could be very wrong, you know Penn and Teller.
Yeah, I love Penn and Teller.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, I think they just don't hang out much of when they're working together. They just lead kind of different lives, which is, I think, pretty neutral. I don't know. I think Simon and Garfunkel famously got along, right?
Yeah, I mean,
They're still chums giving each other Christmas cards.
Yeah, I obviously Art Garfunkel went on to his fantastic career, really blazing trails and leaving what's his name?
Al. Al, because he wrote that song, You Can Call Me Al.
Yeah, Chevy Chase, that's right.
Chevy Chase, that's right.
Yeah, Chevy Chase, I wonder, you know, he's Community got canceled, but I wonder if he's up to anything.
Jaws has to be one of the most entertaining movies I think I've ever seen, just in terms of, like, it sets you on a course, and you're everything is leading up to that. Everything is leading to this climax, and it sets the stakes, and, like, even the little things. I kind of skimmed over this beforehand, but after the mother blames Brody, he has that scene with his son at the table that was entirely improvised, if I recall correctly, where they're just kind of looking at each other and his son's like mimicking him. And it's so sweet, but it again just ties into the themes of, like, you know, his son is one of the people at risk. And that actually happens at one point in the movie, too, is they think that he's going to be attacked by the shark. It's in that scene leads into how much you care about him when he's about to potentially be killed by the shark. It funnels perfectly towards the climax. And I love that about films when they are just tight and focused. And they just power through towards the end.
I think it really works too, because as opposed to its predecessors, the creature features that people were used to at the time, because that's essentially what Jaws is. The Blob and, you know, God, so many other creature features I'm trying to think of. Yeah, and there's ones with telepathic crabs. There's ones with ants from other planets. There's, for some reason, a focus on strange animals or goop. but the thing about this movie is it's so character-driven. It really is, and I think that's why it stands alone and why it's so great. And I think that's why I've always kind of gravitated towards films that are character-driven. The plot doesn't just happen. Everything they do spirals and turns into something else. And you know, the shark itself is territorial. They could have just not gone out there and the shark wouldn't have bothered anybody. The shark isn't some evil mastermind. It's just a force of nature.
Yeah, I mean, like, you look at something like Godzilla. And again, Godzilla's a really good movie, but I feel like Jaws plays that dynamic more of having a whole community that is terrorized by a creature a little bit closer to the chest. You have a clear protagonist. It is able to just walk that line a little bit easier, I feel. And it's just more focused.
Opposed to Godzilla, Jaws takes place in, and it's funny, Jaws has always hit close to home for me because that's where I live. I live by the shore. I spend my whole life around Ocean City. I work there. It's really interesting because that really is how those towns function. They are just summer towns. The rest of the year, it's just a boring nothing. And the 4th of July is the biggest time of year when all these people need to make money. And you know, it's crazy. Like when you have a major city, like, one of these creature features like Godzilla, it tends to take away the personability of, the deaths and the death toll, because when thousands of people are dying at once, it starts to lose its feeling, in a film. But when you see family systematically kind of being picked off, like what we see happen to that mother's child, we see the real effects.
And you get the sense too that pretty much everybody in this town kind of knows each other do.
Yeah.
Knows each other too, yeah.
I always kind of got the feeling of like elitist from all the people that are from the town that were born there. There's a really annoying line, but it's the God's honest truth. It's kind of how people go, oh, the Shubies are coming in. But they said, you're not an islander. It's in the background. It's a blink and you'll miss, or a not paying attention and you'll miss it. You can't really hear through.
Close your ears. Oh, I fucked it up. Close your ears and you'll miss it. There we go. I'll edit it to make it sound like I did it right. Fuck you. Fuck you, Christian.
Yeah, they don't take too kindly to Brody. They don't really respect him. They don't respect Cooper either. Or Hooper, I'm sorry. When he comes in, they tend to only respect people that are from the island.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's and look at what Brody had to deal with prior to the shark attack. Some kids karate chopping fences.
It was truly a small town. Just small Andy Griffith American town.
It really is. And like I said, it's just like that around where I'm from. Nothing really ever happens in Ocean City. There's a little bit of flooding when it rains, and that's about it. And it really makes all the problems personal. And I think that's the great thing about a character-driven film. And had Jaws been more centered around the shark and just attacking, the movie wouldn't work. You wouldn't have these scenes where they're sitting around the dinner table or enjoying a drink together on the boat. Which, by the way, if you didn't know, that scene at the dinner table with his child served as the inspiration for the movie A Quiet Place.
Really?
Yeah.
In fact, next week, little advertisement for next week, we're looking at A Quiet Place and The Fly.
Both fantastic films. But yeah, no, John Krasinski said that scene really spoke to him. And obviously it was so powerful enough that he ended up making a whole movie around it.
Well, it should have served as more inspiration because at the end of that movie, John, you loud boy. Spoiler for A Quiet Place, which like, come on, you know, dude, that's like saying spoilers for Jaws. God. So they decide they're going to head out. They're going to do it on their own. They go out on the Orca. They go Brody, Hooper, and Quint. They start to hunt the shark. They have these harpoon cords that they connect to floating barrels that they're able to kind of track the shark with. A little bit earlier, you have that scene where he says, come shovel some of this shit, where he's throwing the chum into the water. We see Bruce for
the
first time.
He's got those city boy hands. He's got city boy hands. They ain't got blisters on them.
and then the city boy comes through. He says, we're going to need a bigger boat. Which was not improv.
I'm not sure, but I still like the fact that he continued to say it multiple times. And I don't know why I never noticed that until I watched it this time. I've seen Jaws a billion times over. That Jaws was actually we used to play it in my backyard every summer. That would be our movie by the pool. We'd get a projector. But the one thing I never noticed was he keeps saying we're gonna need a bigger boat. He's in some kind of trance, which I think is a great callback, because if you remember in the beginning of the film, he says that he's afraid of water.
That's right.
He is a hydrophobic police chief.
On a coastal town,
which I still never understood why he would move there. I can't imagine they're paying that well.
Hey, you gotta do what you gotta do. Gotta make that bread. They, of course, have that drunken scene together. They're singing some sea shanties like they're on the lighthouse.
I just want to mention this really quick because I really think this is a really awesome, awesome factoid that my dad pointed out to me when I was watching it with him. If you don't know, when they were filming the scene on the boat where they sing their drunken shanties, the shot of them outside the boat when they're running and scurrying, there's it looks fake, but it most certainly is not. When they were filming, there was a meteor shower going on. Really? And there's these bright red stripes that just cascade through the sky, and it's so beautiful and so awesome and so cool. It looks fake, but it is real. And they said that it just happened to happen that day, and they caught it on film, and it ended up in the final in the final product.
All the better for it. That is quite the thing to catch.
Yeah, it's a meteor shower right in the background. It's the best. I think the best cinematography in the movie is when Brody swings around and Hooper's on the other side, and you see him holding up the gun, and all of a sudden you see this big red stripe just fly through the sky.
And that's in a movie full of really, really good shots. I mean, you talk about just one takes are a little overdone, but this one has like some great one take goes. Yeah. Like that one, I forget where somebody pointed this out, one of those movie pretentious movie channels. They pointed out, like, when they're on the boat and Brody's talking to the mayor for the first time and they're ferrying his car, it's a one take, which usually you have the characters move around in the setting, but instead the background moves because it's on the ferry. Keeps it dynamic, even though it's the same shot.
You know what? I never thought of that. That's actually really fascinating.
But yeah, so they end up blowing out the engine. You have Hooper going down in the shark cage to try and stick Bruce with a syringe to euthanize him, basically.
Yeah, I would imagine. But to no avail, it fails. He drops it to the bottom of the ocean, just like everyone's hopes and dreams. He ends up hiding down there for the duration of the film.
Like a real slacker. Like a real Orange Cassidy.
Like a real Orange Cassidy. What a wuss Hooper is. He hid in coral while... I don't want to get too ahead of my skis here. But what happens to Quint? In the next scene, he wasn't even there for him.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's just come right out and get to it. I mean, he gets chomped. Like, Jaws, you would feel relatively safe being like, oh, well, at least we're in the boat. No, Jaws takes it down. The Bruce takes it down and starts to sink the ship, and he just noms on him. He chomps Quint in half.
Yeah, and do you know what I love about that scene? There isn't a single piece of score in it. It's just him struggling. And at first, you know, I'm like, all right, what is he going to do? Slide right into his mouth? No, he fights back. He's kicking. And he just loses his footing. And man, you hear that snap too. Whatever they used, whether it was celery or whatever, whoever the Foley artist was, you hear that chomp. And you see the blood come out of Quint's mouth. It's a very quick scene, but it feels so realistic of just how it just plays out and how that sequence of events happened. There's no music whatsoever.
Well, whoever that Foley artist's mother is, they should be very proud of Mrs. Foley's.
Foley's baby boy.
There we go. Forest wrestling memes. Yeah, no, I agree.
Brian, why don't you put a sock in it? That was a real knee slapper there.
That was pretty good, actually. Wrestling fans will get it.
God. All two of you.
All two of you. So Hooper hides like a little bitch.
He's a little bitch.
Quint dies. Brody's over here like, what the fuck do I do? He sees some of these water or air tanks that are introduced earlier in the film, that if they are jostled too much or if they have too much roughing, they're going to explode. He gets one of these into Bruce's mouth. Smile, you son of a bitch. And shoots him. Or shoots the water. Or excuse me, the air tank. God damn it, I should say. And there is a beautiful explosion of a shark.
There is a beautiful explosion. And not to bring realism into my films, because I really don't like when my films are accurate. But had somebody shot an air tank like that.
Pushes glasses back. Ahem.
had somebody shot an air tank like that, it would have just shot off like a torpedo. It would not have exploded like that. The shark wouldn't have turned into chum. And I'm not trying to be the actually guy, but maybe the tank would have gone through the shark.
Actually, the name of the character is Matt Hooper.
Or as I've been calling, by the way, Matt Hooper. Matt Hooper. The character of Matt Hooper I always think is funny because we always have a scientist in every creature feature, right?
Yeah.
And I always love to call them Dr. Exposition, because that's all they serve.
That's what they do. Matt that's Hooper the purpose.
Matt Hooper does at least more than the average scientist. He gets down and dirty. He was trying to stick the shark, and he was taking a couple of chomps close to him. But typically those characters are just expositional pieces.
Yeah.
Matt Hooper really does get involved, and I think that's another great mark of Jaws.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, he is a central character through and through. You know, except when he's a little bitch, and only comes back at this point in the film when the shark is dead. And he's like, Quint, did he make it? He's like, no, you could have helped him.
I like that he smiled through the whole thing, too, when he told him. Quint was completely forgotten about because of the how jovial they were about killing the shark.
Yeah, they pleasantly just kind of paddle on home. They have to explain to his family, like, oh, yeah, your loved one is dead.
I doubt Quint had a family, though.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
His family were the barnacles on the bottom of the orca. If anything, the orca was his only family.
Hey, and that's dead, too.
Actually, I don't think we'd have any great white sharks around Martha's Vineyard. That doesn't really line up with with their coastal patterns. Actually,
nerd. If you had to rate this movie, what would you give it?
My God, you know, it's really hard to rank a movie like Jaws just because it's reached that iconic status. It's so difficult to give it anything below a 9. It really is.
I'd have to agree. I would.
It's such a watchable movie. It's such a rewatchable movie.
It is.
It really doesn't get old, because I've seen Jaws probably every summer for the past 10 years. And it still, to this day, is still so enjoyable.
It's just endlessly entertaining. It's a near perfect movie. I would say it is almost a 10. It is almost a 10. I don't know. It might be, but I want to keep it sacred. I want to keep the 10 sacred for now. For now, it's a 9, but upon rewatch. So, that brings us to our next film.
Peeping Tom.
Peeping Tom, 1960, which, by the way, I forgot to mention the seedings for these films when introducing them. They are 32 and 33, respectively, which is slightly mind-boggling. But at the same time, I don't think you would normally classify Jaws as a typical horror. So that might be where it is not the highest in terms of its seating. Peeping Tom, however, through and through, a horror movie.
Absolutely. And like we were saying earlier about the just how influential Peeping Tom was, I just wanted to get a couple of things out of the way just to kind of mention this. I saved this quote on my phone. So as you mentioned, Michael Powell's career was pretty much ruined after this film, which still blows me away. His prior film before that, he was nominated for an Academy Award. After that, he was completely blackballed. But yeah, Dilly Powell, the Sunday Times, funny enough, she has the same last name as the writer of this film, complained that Peeping Tom was essentially vicious. And nobody had stepped forward in Powell's defense. Upon her death in 1995, she recanted her original view of Peeping Tom and said, "I find I am convinced that this is a masterpiece. If in some afterlife conversation is permitted, I shall think it is my duty to seek out Michael Powell and apologize."
That's really saying something. To go from a negative review to a masterpiece, and one of the big reasons that this did come to be reviewed as a big masterpiece is Martin Scorsese, who I think went out of his way to have a re-release of this
film. I was going to say, he re-released the film. He said that movie was so integral to his career, and you can see why. I mean, I get a lot of different vibes from it that I get in A Taxi Driver or a Dog Day Afternoon. How many times were we put in the shoes of the killer or the antagonist up until this point? And to get a first-person perspective of what it's like to be in their shoes.
It's funny. I always attributed like Red Deep with preceding Halloween in terms of showing the killer's POV. This precedes both of those. I forget exactly when Red Deep came out. I think that's another film on this top 64 tournament that we have here. But I know Halloween was like 78. So this is a good, like, when somebody was born around when Peeping Tom came out, they were a legal adult when Halloween recreated these killer POV shots.
Yeah, and it's really, really incredible to think how much ground this film covered, even for what would come later in that decade, even later that year. Psycho was a critical masterpiece and a commercial success. Maybe it just was the British audience that might have not been ready for it. Maybe American audiences were just ready to see something like that. Or maybe it just took the brilliance of Alfred Hitchcock, because I would say that Psycho is a tighter movie than Peeping Tom.
It is definitively a better film.
Yes. But that's not to say that this movie isn't incredible for what it is. And maybe that's why I am looking at this film so fondly, because I know some people really love the performances given by the actors, but I really think it's more of just the story that I'm more interested in, and just how incredibly innovative it was. I mean, it truly is a source of creative inspiration, and seeing what Scorsese would do later in the next decade, You really, really get the sense that this without this movie, we wouldn't have had a movie like A Taxi Driver. We wouldn't have had a Halloween.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have had people pushing buttons like Michael Powell did.
Absolutely. It's certainly interesting to see, like, those beginning shots. I was like, this is fucking Halloween. This is just Halloween.
That's exactly what I wrote down in my notes here. And by the way, I also I incorrectly mentioned that Michael Powell wrote the film. He did not write the film. I believe it was Leo Ma. I can't even read my own handwriting.
It is. It is Leo Marx.
Leo Marx.
But it was directed by and produced by Michael Powell.
And do you want to know something else that's really interesting about this film? Is it's one of the first instances of full frontal nudity in a movie.
Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, at the time this film was so blasphemous and so horrible, it's very tastefully done. You just kind of see it in the background with the pictures.
I'll tell you what, I didn't even know until you brought it up just now. That's how tasteful it is, or how subtle it is.
Because it's actually a kind of humorous way they incorporate it. He's a photographer by day and a killer by night. But no, he's taking pictures for this pornographic company. I don't even remember the name of it. But a man comes in and he kind of flips through the book and he sees all the different women, and they cover it up with the educational books bag.
Yeah,
and then they give him a Sunday Times.
And that's the other thing too, is it's not just there for the sake of it being there. It is part of the plot. It is part of who this character is, because he also is kind of in the same way as Psycho, clearly frustrated in that department.
Oh, absolutely. And there's so many parallels to Psycho. I saw a supercut on YouTube when I was looking through the film just to get like a quick refresher before the podcast. And somebody cut all the similarities of Psycho and Peeping Tom together. And it's astounding. It really is astounding.
It's not even them copying off of each other either, because they came out the same year.
And they were both released in two separate countries.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just the that creative overlap. Even down to things just like they both drink milk and they both invite a woman in to have milk and sandwiches, and that they both have frustrations from their parents who ended up marrying or finding another lover, right? And that really set them off.
Yeah.
Wanting to continue their family's legacy. It's incredible the amount of similarities between the two.
The film starts out with, again, a POV shot. It is Mark Lewis's POV, and he is going to see Dora, who is not, in fact, an explorer, but was she a prostitute or somebody just doing a photo?
She is a lady of the night.
She is a lady of the night, which monstrously, Mark kills her. The next day, we see the police are examining the scene, and that POV shot is back as Mark kind of snoops around. Of course, nobody is taking note of him, but he's taking note of the investigation. We get to know him a little bit more as the film continues. He works on a film crew. What's that?
He works. No, I was going to say, we see that he's a very hardworking guy. We see that he's kind of moonlighting two jobs between working at this kind of like kind of seedy pornography store, whatever you want to call it. But also working on a film production. And he it's really interesting to see his work ethic. that he even has time for all these things. And his whole life is shrouded in his work. I mean, he basically lives in a red room.
To almost a degree of cliche, or maybe cliche is not the right word, but it's his life entirely revolves around pictures and images, recordings, cameras, all that good stuff. It really is all, you know, his life is entirely that, and his apartment is basically just the red room.
If you don't know, the movie industry frowns on antagonists or villains ever using actual name brand products. And I think it's really funny that we see unbox a Kodak box.
No, absolutely.
I'm sure they were happy knowing that they were associated with a serial killer who's sexually frustrated and filming women at their most vulnerable.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm surprised, and I'm surprised that they went on to sponsor that horrendous self-rhyme in Pitbull's Everything Tonight, or whatever the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I believe Chevy Chase also made a song about Kodak.
Of course.
Kodachrome.
Noted member of Garfunkel and Chase. We get to know Mark. He is a bit of a shy individual. He meets a newer tenant in his building named Helen, who was celebrating her 21st birthday. She also has a blind mother, and he invites her up to their room, up to his apartment, so that they can get to know each other a little bit more. She is fascinated by his work. He is still very awkward, though it seems that they have a little bit of chemistry together.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel, though, his performance is almost too awkward.
Yeah, no, I mean, Norman Bates definitely walks that line a little bit better.
I feel like... Oh, sorry.
No,
I was going to say, I think the problem with me, maybe, in terms of Mark's character in this film, not only does he look like two different eras of David Bowie blended together. He looks like a cross between the Thin White Duke and Modern Love David Bowie. But the fact that I even have it written here, he really doesn't have a charm like Norman does. He really doesn't have that charisma.
He doesn't. Yeah, that like silent charisma, it's not quite there. Even though he
doesn't have that likability.
He is soft on the eyes. I do agree. He does have that appeal like David Bowie kind of did. The next day we see him working on the set. He has an after hours shoot, quote unquote, with Vivian, who is a stand-in, and she's wanting to get her big break, and he says he's going to offer that to her, but he ends up killing her. And he does it, he reveals his method of murder in this way, where he has a blade on the end of his tripod, and he is obsessed with catching it. Sorry?
He strokes it quite sexually.
There is quite a lot of I would say subtext, but it's a little bit more surface than sub.
it definitely is. The way he grasps that, he really knows how to make a blade seem so sensual.
Which, I mean, hey, a lot of people who analyze horror in a literary or academic way, that is like how they often view knives, is that is supposed to be like a phallic stand-in. So he's obsessed with capturing their moments of greatest fear through the lens of the camera, which is something I meant to I accidentally skimmed over when he
I was going to say that actually.
It's a big plot point, so shame on me. So Helen comes up, and she watches some of the old films that Mark's father used to take of him when they would expose him to a lot of the a lot of like rats or creatures or just things that were really scary or morbid. He caught it, if I remember correctly.
It's a lizard.
Yeah, a lizard. And then also the moments leading up and thereof, they caught him experiencing his mother's death, right?
Yeah. So when I watched this, I don't know if I was the only one who thought this for Mark. But, you know, these bright lights and these lizards and all these things that his father used to do to him every night. You don't think he'd catch on after the first week and go, Jesus Christ, Dad, come on.
Look, he's like six. He's like, oh, what was he going to say? You know, his dad's like this. His dad's a psychologist. That's why he wants to.
No, all I'm saying is that at a certain point, I wouldn't get scared anymore.
Oh, that's a good point. You would think you would almost become desensitized. I get used to the bright
lights. I just sleep through it. I'd adapt.
He's obsessed with seeing these moments, and he wants to film them and therefore relive them. So he kills Vivian and puts her in a chest that is on stage, which the next day is used as a prop within their filming process. And when they pull over that chest and you see the actor go, oh, this is heavier than I remember.
I gotta say, that is fan. By the way, those two sequences are fantastic. I really do. These two scenes are by far the best scenes in the entire film. Because we know what's going to happen to Vivian throughout the entire thing, which I think only added to this intense suspense. But the next morning, I might be strange for assuming that he would have discarded the body, right? That he may not want to be caught, but obviously he does, is the fact that when they pull that chest, it threw me off. Because I'm like, oh my God. He's like, this is heavy. It did surprise me. And maybe that was just me, but I do think that is just a subtle piece in there that was just really well done. It's that initial struggle to pull it.
And it makes you think, oh God, they're going to find it. And I think one of the reasons that he left that there was he wanted to film people's reactions because he knew he was going to be there.
He's like a YouTuber listening to Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time.
So they find her. They have the police come in. He is filming the police, conducting their interviews, which kind of sets them off. And they also are intruded upon by him when he's filming them through the rafters as they're at the crime scene. And there's a intense moment where a pen falls out of his pocket and they hear it and they're like, who's there? And nothing really comes of it at this time. Eventually they are tipped off, but he goes back to his normal life. He goes on a date with Helen. And they start to hit it off. They almost kiss. Eventually, her mother comes upstairs to his apartment. And she has some of the videos playing of his murders. But she can't see because she's blind. She doesn't realize what's going on. But she does imagine something is wrong with him. And I gotta say, you're familiar with Red Dragon, right?
I am familiar with Red Dragon, yes.
This is straight out of Red Dragon. I have to imagine this was inspiration for Red Dragon, too.
Oh, absolutely. And funny enough, I don't know if this is true, but a lot of films around this time were also inspired by the Adeen murders. So I don't know if... Sorry?
Did he film his stuff?
No, I, you know, like, a lot of the, a lot of the crime scene stuff was published in books, and that's what served as the inspiration for Psycho.
Right.
And for Silence of the Lambs. I'm not sure about Peeping Tom, though, only because that was in a whole nother country. So I can't imagine. Maybe that kind of stuff spread over there. I don't know what the time was like back in 1960, whether or not that kind of murder took the world by storm, or if it was just a truly American thing. But yes, I was thinking the same thing when I saw it was I was thinking Red Dragon. It's weird because this movie, you start to see your other films that you're so fond of and that you've been fond of your whole life and go, oh my God, what creativity, what originality. And you realize that they've all kind of gotten it from this film.
Right, exactly. Eventually the police do become aware of Mark's crimes. Around the same time, Helen comes to his apartment and very curiously turns on one of the films by herself, and Mark comes upon this and sees that she's seen evidence of his crime, and he explains his motives. And there's that fantastic shot of her in the reflective glass. He has like a reflective glass on the front of his camera too, so the victim can see themselves. And he says he can't. And very similar to Red Dragon 2, though this is pretty prototypical as well, I guess. He says he can't hurt her. So the cops are coming and they can hear them outside. He decides he's going to take his own life. So he props up the camera over on a mantle, decides to drive his own neck into the knife while staring at his own reflection.
Without an ounce of blood, mind you. It's not until we discover the dead blood. Body. It's not until we discover the dead body that there's a couple little ketchup squirts on his neck.
It is it is shockingly tame. So a good film, if for nothing else, inspiring Halloween Resurrection and that one tripod kill in that one. Though I don't think that one had a blade. I think Michael Myers just kind of brute forced it.
Anyway. We got a couple of great quotes though from this film. I'm just going to read one from Helen's mother. I really like this one. Don't trust a man who walks quietly. He's shy, but his footsteps aren't.
Wait, so his footsteps are loud then?
I guess.
So he should not shy. His be trusted? Aren't shy. Oh, okay. That's kind of anti-introverted people. It's a little okay there.
Well, I mean, what are they going to do? Are they going to come out of their shell and yell at her? Are they going to stand up for themselves?
I suppose not. Checkmate. If you had to rate this film out of 10, what would you give it?
So, I think it has, and I know I've been saying this a lot for a lot of these films, but I'm going to judge it for what it is of the time. I mean, this movie is so ahead of its time. It's such an inspirational movie to watch just to see how much of an impact it had, despite all the criticism, despite all of the negativity, and despite all the hardship that the director had to endure. I would give this film a strong 8, an 8.5 maybe.
Sure. Yeah. No, I feel that. I'll be honest. I was watching this in a bit of a blitz of movies that I was watching for this tournament. So I'll be honest, it didn't necessarily blow me away, but I still thought it was really good. and certainly worth your time. I'm going to say it's a solid 7.
I more or less would agree with that for a ranking of watchability, but in the way I'm looking at it, I'm trying to look at it for its significance and its impact.
Sure, yeah, and that's valid. Like, it's certainly between Scorsese and what it did for the horror genre.
John Carpenter. I would agree with you on a sense of just the film alone, but looking at its impact, I feel like it deserves a little bit of extra points, in my opinion.
Sure, yeah. Well, with that, that leads us to the most important question for this week. And I think we both are in agreement once again. Which one advances?
I am going to have to say, no, this one's pretty easy. I think everybody knows where we're both going, and I think I could speak for Brian and myself here. We're definitely going with Jaws. Jaws is the more iconic movie. Jaws is the overall better movie. It's so much more watchable. And Jaws is really the first major summer blockbuster as well.
Yeah, nothing against Peeping Tom, but I'm gonna have to agree. It's definitely Jaws this week. Definitely, just I don't know. It is amazing. It's an outstanding film. Now the unfortunate thing is, we in the second round have Psycho versus Jaws.
That's going to be a difficult one. I'm even questioning myself on that one.
That, when we reach it, might be the first time that it really feels like we don't know. But for this week, Jaws advances. You got anything you want to plug, my friend?
Yeah. I like giving up a little bit of my time to plug other people. So if you guys ever get a chance, check out Dead Meat. They're a fantastic YouTube channel, as well as Spooky Rice. I've been on a Spooky Rice binge. I really, really love that channel.
It is really good.
Just fair warning. I mean, it is called Disturbing Breakdown for a reason. There are a lot of films that on there that I would love to cover in the near future. A lot of films that I had never heard of that I'm now falling in love with. But yeah, no, Spooky Rice is great. If you guys can, please, you know, subscribe to us. Give us likes on Instagram. My personal Instagram's ChristianRocco41, and my professional wrestling account is at RealJCopeland. Follow us on Pretentious Movie Sheet on Instagram, and make sure you follow us on Pretentious Movie Sheet on YouTube. Go out and do something nice for somebody. The world's crazy right now. Donate to whoever you can, if you can. Help out a small business. Help out somebody in need. Call somebody and cheer them up. Make their day.
Absolutely. And Twitter is also at Movie Sheet, if you want to follow the podcast there. If we're on Apple Music or Apple Podcasts at this time, go rate us 5 stars. So there's that. And I think that's...
Recommend us to your friends, please, if you can. We want to see if we can get as many viewers as possible. The more, the merrier. And the more people on here, the better the production gets, the better the movies get, the better the reviews get.
The better, just...